Good afternoon, and calling State Affairs to order at 3:04 p.m. in the Max Grunberg Room of the Capitol, Thursday, April 8th, 2021. Members present from my left to my right are Representatives Vance, Tarr, Kaufman, and Story, and myself, Chair Chris Tompkins. And with five members present, we have a quorum to conduct business, and Representative Klayman informed me he'll be here imminently. Our usual thanks to Sophia, who's online with House Records, and Tom in the back of the room with LIO for facilitating today's meeting. And we have two items on today's agenda: House Bill 106, relating to missing persons under 21 years old, Governor's Bill, it's a federal sort of conforming bill, and then House Bill 102, a first hearing relating to the State Insurance and Catastrophic Reserve Account. And we'll start with House Bill 106. There was an amendment deadline yesterday of 5 p.m., and we had one amendment submitted by the deadline from Representative Vance. Online today, we have Kathy Monfreda from DPS, Casey Schroeder from Department of Law, Claire Radford from Legislative Legal Services, and Lieutenant Paul Fusi from the Department of Public Safety. And so those resources are available if the committee has questions both on the amendment or the underlying bill. At this time, I think we can take up our singular amendment. Representative Vance. We can take a brief at ease. Going back on the record, Representative Vance.
I move amendment number one.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the last hearing of this bill regarding the missing persons, I asked about, for the department to speak to the value of raising the age from 18 to 21. And it was mentioned that that age group, the college age group, is still very susceptible to coercion. And I got to thinking about that, and the further question that I asked in my mind was, well, what does that coercion lead to? And in many cases, it can often lead to human trafficking. And so I felt that our human trafficking laws do not include the word coercion. And coercion is very is one of the primary ways that traffickers will get people to either engage with them for commercial sex acts or for labor. And this is where so many people get trapped. And I spoke with the department with our legal department and asked about the simplicity of putting this in there. And they said, well, we have the word deception. So I compared the term deception and coercion, and clearly they're two different things. So the amendment that we came up with was just simply adding to our human trafficking definition the word or by coercion. But today, after speaking with the Department of Law in the administration, their concern was that if we added this word, that it would actually, if it were brought in court under, a crime, that it could be reduced, it could actually reduce a crime. And that is something that we don't want to happen. We do have coercion in definition, but not when it comes to human trafficking. So if I could have Casey Schroeder of Department of Law speak to these concerns, I think that would be helpful for the committee.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Vance. And before we go to Ms. Schroeder, let the record reflect that Representative Klayman joined us at 3:06 p.m. and Representative Eastman joined us at 3:09 p.m. Ms. Schroeder, if you're with us, please put yourself on record and feel free to present Department of Law's perspectives on this amendment and the issues that Representative Vance raised.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Okay. This is Casey Schroeder. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law and the Criminal Division. Basically, the concern from the Department of Law was that we were unsure what the sponsor meant by the word coercion. There is a separate crime of coercion, and that is in Title 11. But there's also other meanings of coercion, and we were unsure which definition the sponsor wanted to refer to based on the way it's drafted. If the sponsor meant to include the crime of coercion as it appears in Title 11, it is possible that without any other amendments, a defense attorney could argue that the conduct, the broader crime of coercion, which is a Class C felony and a lower class of offense than human trafficking, which is a Class A felony, that we needed to charge the lower offense. There would have needed to have been other amendments made to those statutes in order to prevent that from happening. So as drafted, we had some concerns with implementing the amendment consistent with the intent of the legislature.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder, for that and for your willingness to work with me on this. So with this information, it shows me how much work we have to do on our clarifying our human trafficking legislation statutes and the definition of coercion as it applies. And so I have been working on a more comprehensive bill in human trafficking, and right now our statutes have separate areas. One is sex trafficking, one is human trafficking. And this is just an example of how we need to bring things together and clarify that coercion is a factor in human trafficking, but make sure that if we're going to include it in definition, we want to have a prosecution to the full extent of the law. And in the case of the missing persons, we don't want the lesser of the crime. So it is my intent after the committee, if the committee wants to discuss this further, that in light of the advice of Ms. Schroeder and it not being the full intent of what I'm looking for, I would like to withdraw this amendment at this time.
Thank you, Representative Vance, for highlighting these issues. And with that, amendment number 1A.1 is withdrawn. Although perhaps, yes, Representative Clayman.
I just have one question for Ms. Schroeder since she was on the.
Absolutely. Yeah. Representative Clayman.
I don't object to withdrawing it, but she's on the phone. Ms. Schroeder, I was just curious if, in terms of your work with the Department of Law, here in Alaska, are the majority, who's doing most of the prosecution of sex trafficking? Is that happening more by the federal government and in federal prosecutions, or is that happening more on the state level? If you know.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, it's happening on both, and I couldn't tell you who's doing more or less of it. I do know that we work pretty closely. We do have a prosecutor that focuses on sex trafficking, and that person works pretty closely with federal prosecutors. But as far as who's doing more than of it, I don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee on this subject? Representative Eastman. And I think maybe we'll allow just a couple more questions and I think give the proper exposure to the amendment that Representative Vance raised, and then we can set aside and move on, but perhaps we will see this in another form or vehicle later. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I just wanted to get, make sure I understand kind of where the sponsor was going, and just wondering, with this amendment, were you trying to get into scenarios where there was drug use involved, or was that part of the thinking, or something other than that?
Through the chair, I was trying to get our human trafficking definitions to up to the federal standard that includes the word coercion, because that is so often included, and because it was specifically mentioned last hearing on this bill with the missing persons, I thought that it would be appropriate to add it at this time. But I had not thought of specifically drugs, but I know that there are instances of coercion that does not involve drugs, so the definition, you know, could be broad, but in this case, we would have to, I didn't want to bog down this bill with expanding more amendments beyond my intent right now. So I will be pursuing this and have been working with the Department of Law on a more comprehensive human trafficking bill. And, you know, we'll work with other committee members on other ways that we can address this. But I want to make sure that because it's so important that we get it right in our definitions.
Thank you.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. Just wanted to say I appreciate the focus on this and look forward to working on that, too. I know many people in my district and across the state are really concerned about this, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Story. I think that's a good wrap-up comment that probably reflects the sentiments of the committee. Thank you, Representative Vance, for bringing forward Amendment Number 1. And with that dispensed of, that takes us back to the bill before us as a whole. Are there any lingering questions before we go to wrap-up comment and a motion? Seeing no questions, wrap-up comments on House Bill 106. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the administration bringing this forward and tightening up our legislation to be able to report in a quicker manner on missing persons. This is obviously an issue that a lot of people aren't aware of and the overlap that it has with human trafficking. And this last year, we've gotten more insight in the news and from our congressional delegation with missing and murdered Indigenous women. But what a lot of people don't realize is that it does involve human trafficking, and that's why it's really been highlighted in my mind. And a lot of people in my district have been unaware of how bad our missing persons and human trafficking is. But we have one of our locals that has gone missing, and we still don't have a story of, you may be familiar with Duffy, who has been missing for about a year and a half now. And, she doesn't fit this under 21 age category, but it's still very relevant as Alaskans that we become more aware of the signs of people who are being sought after and go missing, and that we continue to pursue this because proportionally here in the state, it's affecting us so much more than we realize. And knowing that at least 25% of our homeless are often trafficked, and they fit in that missing persons category. So I really appreciate the administration bringing this forward and giving us an opportunity to speak to this and to continue to highlight this to Alaskans.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Other comments on House Bill 106? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I just wanted to make two comments for the record, and hopefully as the bill continues in the process, there'll be more ability to dig into it. But it certainly is important to understand how we intend reasonable efforts to be interpreted on page 2, line 9. And that can either, if left without a strong intent behind it, that could lead either to the requirement for reasonable efforts being ineffective, or it could also, on the other extreme, it could mean that there's a lot of work being done by law enforcement that will be extremely difficult to work into all the other tasks that we are asking law enforcement to do. So reasonable may mean one thing to one other person. I'd just like to make sure that as the bill continues through the process, that we make clear what our intent for reasonable is in that particular section. And then there's also appearing in section 2, there's the requirement to remove information once a missing person has been located. And we have a 24-hour requirement on that. It certainly is the case that when you originally hear that someone's been located, sometimes that information turns out not to actually be the case, and it can take you longer than 24 hours to get to the bottom of it to figure that out. So in those sorts of situations, the 24-hour requirement may be in need of some further refinement. Thank you.
These comments are noted. Representative Coffa.
Thank you. Through the chair, with respect to those comments, I often look at the committees of referral, and I see the next stop is health and social services. Just wonder if judiciary might not be a strong committee to look at some of those questions. And it seems appropriate for a bill of this nature.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman. And I count that as a comment, and it may be worth raising that consideration to the Judiciary Chairman who sits among us, as well as the Speaker who makes the referrals, but very much noted. Any further comments on House Bill 106, Representative Clayman?
I'll just respond briefly to the question raised by Representative Kaufman. This bill is really intended and does one specific thing, which gets our statutes in line with federal law so that we can get federal funds to do the very act that which this is to have missing persons report. And I appreciate the idea that Judiciary Committee could add much to the process. I don't think we could add anything to the process. We've had a very robust process here. Representative Vance has brought an interesting amendment that is an important topic. I think we are all concerned about human trafficking, and the level of human trafficking going on in Alaska is a concern to all of us. I was talking to a retired federal prosecutor just in the last week about the efforts they undergo in terms of ferreting out and prosecuting human trafficking. This bill needs no judiciary analysis, because I can assure you we did more here than the Judiciary Committee would do. But I appreciate the thought, and I think it's a good bill, and I support it.
All right. Comments from Representative Clayman and Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't going to say anything, but I think just given the other comments, it's important to put on the record that the research shows for teenage runaways that it's typically within 48 hours that a young person is trafficked. So the time piece of it is really critical to do quickly. And so I hope that they will be able to do it within 24 hours, because it's less likely that they'll be able to help that young person the more time goes on. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. And, Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with the comments that Rep. Tarr made, how important the urgency of this is, and I'm glad we are aligning our state law with federal law, and I hope this just flies through the process and gets past the session. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Story. And to that last point of letting this fly through the process, we can now entertain a motion to that end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to report committee substitute for House Bill 106, Version A, out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying two fiscal notes.
Seeing and hearing no objection, the motion carries, and House Bill 106 is discharged from State Affairs and will proceed on to the Health and Social Services Committee. And we'll circulate the paperwork as we keep trucking along. That takes us to the second item on today's agenda, House Bill 102. This is a first hearing in State Affairs. And this is another governor's bill, state insurance, relating to state insurance and the catastrophic reserve account. That said, it's a subject I think familiar to all, because this was previewed in the Finance Subcommittee process. And let me just say on the record that Director Isaacs with DOA also was able to sort of enlighten me to the, I think, pretty substantial upsides to the state with this legislation. So I've been looking forward to this hearing for a while, which I don't often say about bills that relate to insurance. And so we have Scott Jordan with DOA, the Director of the Division of Risk Management, as well as Director Isaacs online available for questions. And we're going to start with a slide presentation from Scott Jordan. And what I think I'm going to do is hold questions for the balance of the presentation. And so if you have questions, feel free to write down what slide they might relate to. And then at the end of the presentation, we'll sort of dive in wholesale. So Scott Jordan, if you can hear us, we've got the slide deck up on the screen. But go ahead and put yourself on record, and I think our committee at Jeff Stepp is ready to advance the slides as you verbally direct.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Chair Christ-Tompkins and the other members of the House State of Affairs. I appreciate you guys taking this up and giving me an opportunity to present this bill. This is House Bill 102. I am the Director of Risk Management and within the Department Administration. Go to the next slide, please. The purpose of the HB 102 is to increase the cap from a current $5 million unencumbered balance to a $50 million unencumbered balance. And the reason we want to do this is to allow the state to be able to self-insure its property coverage. We currently self-insure for workers' comp and general liability, and due to the global property insurance markets hardening, which means tougher for us to reach capacity for the large amount of property that we have, we saw a 30% increase in insurance costs from FY20 to 21, and we're being told now to expect from 21 to 22 another 15 to 20%. The current limit on catastrophic coverage that we purchase is $50 million. So if we have a catastrophic event such as an earthquake or a flood, the maximum amount that we purchase is $50 million. And that's why we're looking for this fund to be increased to $50 million. And if this bill does pass, we'll be able to save those annual premiums that we're currently paying out. Next slide, please. This is just a copy of the catastrophic reserve account statute. It's section 3705289. I've highlighted some of the key points in the statute. The first being that the assets of the account may be used to obtain insurance, establish reserves for the self-insurance program, and to satisfy claims or judgments arising under the program. And the second two highlighted areas just show that right now the current cap on it is $5 million unencumbered. Next slide, please. This slide shows the expenditures we've had out of the cap fund since the inception, and that was in 1988 or fiscal year 88. There's a lot of numbers on this page, I understand, but if you look all the way to the right, you can see the total expended is about $149 million, and that works out to about a little over $4.5 million a year. So up until now, the limit of $5 million has been sufficient. However, with wanting to self-insure property coverages for catastrophic loss, we're looking to increase that to the $50 million. Next slide, please. This is a 10-year history of our property premiums versus our property losses. If you look at the blue line, that's going to be our property premiums. And over on the left, you can see that we've gone from a premium in FY10 of about $2 million to FY20 of $5.1 million. We had a little bit of an increase in FY12, which was due to a catastrophic, they did a modeling, insurers did a modeling of Alaska and increased it by 275%. And of course, they couldn't increase the premiums by that, but we did see a little bit of an increase. We compensated for that a little bit by taking all the property off of the schedule that goes to our carriers under $5 million because the cap fund set at $5 million. And from FY12 to about FY17, we saw kind of a balancing in there, not too much of an increase. And then starting in FY18, we started to see an increase again all the way up to FY20 of the $5.1 million. If you look over on the orange or brown column there and look at the graph of that, that's basically all of the property losses that we paid out. This isn't what the insurance paid out. This is what we paid out. Pretty pretty low except for a couple of spikes, one in FY15 and the other one in FY20. The one in FY15, if you look at the notes down below, was from the Crystal Lake Hatchery fire in March of 2014. We paid about $4 million on that. And then the other two were from FY20. One was due to the earthquake claims, which we're still paying on, and the other was due to a full retention of $1 million that we paid on a DOT maintenance shop that had a snow collapse in Graff. Next slide, please. This slide just shows the difference of what we pay in property premiums compared to what we pay overall in all of our premiums. And if you look at that first column there, you can see that we've, over the 10 years, we've paid about $39 million in property premiums, and we've paid $80 million overall in insurance. So property is about half of what we pay out in premiums. And so we're hoping that, you know, by passing this legislation, we'll save at least that in our premiums, if not more, because we expect the increases in property premiums to continue. Next slide, please. This is just a kind of a short list of the larger claims that we've paid out of the catastrophic reserve account. Alaska Marine Highways had, everybody I think was aware of, the Laconi grounding in May of 2004. The Crystal Lake Hatchery, as we discussed before, about $4 million. The Alaska Aerospace Launch Facility rocket explosion in 2014. We paid out $1.5 million. That claim actually was a $34 million claim, but it was paid by the carriers, and then they subrogated or collected back against the Alaska Aerospace customer who paid the other $17 million. So, but out of risk management funds, we paid about $1.5 million. We've paid about $5.8 million so far in the PFOS claims, and we've paid about $1.2 million so far in the earthquake claims. Next slide, please. This slide really just kind of shows how the CAT fund is funded each year. We typically will fund from risk management, any funds left over from risk management from year to year. If that doesn't fully fill the CAT fund to the unencumbered balance of $5 million, then we use lapse funds. And typically what happens is once we figure out what we need, we will do a memo to the Division of Finance through the commissioner, the Department Administration commissioner, asking for a certain amount. And this slide here just kind of shows, we're the third one on the list there, and it kind of shows what we've requested from 18 to 20. All right, that was the short presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Director Jordan. I am thrilled about legislation that saves money for the state operating budget, and this is such a bill. Representative Clayman.
Can you turn back to the slide? Keep going. Stop there. Perfect. So the slide which has the premiums paid and the losses compared, this shows what we paid in premiums and what we actually paid out of pocket on those losses, which presumably is the deductible amount on some of the areas where we have insurance. Do you have a statistic that shows what the payouts were by the insurance company on the claims that we paid whatever our deductible was? Or maybe it's retention in this world, but is there some show of how much the insurance companies are paying?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Clayman, I can get you that. This does not show that, but I can certainly get you that. But I do know for that period of time, we had only one claim of significance, and that was the Alaska Aerospace claim. I don't think we've had any other claims. Now, we do have, in FY20, we still are working on the DOT maintenance shop snow collapse. That's about a $3.8 million claim, and we paid our $1 million retention on that, and they're still working on the on the insurance side. So, but I can get you that information.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that would be helpful because I'd actually like to see how much the insurance companies were paying out, because I think it's even more reason to pass this bill if it turns out that the premiums we were paying exceeded the losses that the insurance companies paid out. Thank you.
Yeah, through the chair, I with the Alaska Aerospace claim, I don't know that it would exceed it, but we certainly would see many years where we didn't get any payments from the insurance carriers.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Coughlin.
Thank you. Through the chair, as I look at this, so I see, you know, increasing from $5 million to $50 million, just, and it kind of plays into the other question of how much of that fund is going to be used at a given point. So, in other words, what's left laying around, and how is it being managed? How, what would the investment profile be for it? If it builds up, if we don't have claims and we have a large cash balance in it? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, good question. It's the fund has an unencumbered, currently has an unencumbered balance of $5 million. It can never have more than $5 million in there. With this legislation, if this passes, it would have a balance of $50 million. Now, that does not mean that there's not encumbered amounts. Like, for instance, right now, we have an unencumbered balance of $5 million, but I have about $6.2 million encumbered waiting for those claims to settle. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but, you know, there's been years where we've not used any of the fund, and there's been years where we've used all of the fund.
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair, yeah, I guess the question is the management plan of this optimized for, like, total yield benefit? If part of it can be invested in a way, if it does build up and somehow we know we have float, and how is that portion of it optimized in a way that's maybe semi-liquid, where it could be, if you have an encumbrance that comes upon it where it's liquid enough where you can get it, but it's being managed for optimum return rather than just in a cash account.
Through the chair, and I think I'm understanding your question. The interest off this account is managed by our Department of Revenue. We don't get any interest off of this. It just has a max amount of $50 million in the account.
Follow up?
Yes. Thank you. I guess my question still stands. I guess I have to check with Department of Revenue.
Through the chair, actually, Admin Director Leslie Isaacs is on the phone, and he may be able to answer that question for you.
And just to confirm the question you're asking, Representative Kaufman, is the question, you know, say this balance gets up to $50 million, if this bill passes, is your question, are we just going to let that money sit in the bank and collect bank interest, which is basically nothing, or do we want to manage it for return if it's just sitting around? Is that the question?
Correct. Yes. Does it become another managed fund with an investment profile? It's a risk balanced, you know, allocation of investments that's appropriate for the time horizon and the potential cash demand on the account.
No, it's a great question. Director Isaacs, any insight on that Representative Kaufman's question?
Thank you, Chair Christ-Tompkins and Representative Kaufman. I believe we're going to have to check in with the Department of Revenue and find out what the investment portfolio looks like and if it includes the CAP fund.
Yeah, I think maybe as a request from the committee, Mr. Jordan, Mr. Isaacs, if possible to let my office know and Jeff Stepp, my committee aide, know what you find out, we can distribute that to the committee. But I think it's an excellent point. If this fund, you know, basically increases by an order of magnitude from 5 to 50, and want to make sure that we get maximum return for that asset. Representative Vance.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, I'm wondering if that is the case, is there any legislative action that we need to do to make that adjustment, before we get too deep into this bill? I think that would be appropriate because, $5 million is a very different, $50 million is a very different number, very different asset than $5 million, and we want to make sure that we're managing the people's resource well and making sure that it has the flexibility that Rep. Kaufman is speaking of, because this could obviously has the potential to really benefit us in having that flexibility to deal with our own emergencies and maximize that dollar. So I think it's very exciting, but making sure that at the very beginning we put in the right funding and, the mechanisms in place for the investment necessary. So if that could be part of the question, is there any further legislative action that we need to take in this bill in order to maximize that potential?
Yeah, I would echo that, and I think hopefully DOA takes that under advisement, and we'll wait to hear from the agency or agencies, as it were. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And I'm curious, what is the regulatory or other mechanism that requires that the this money be sort of kept on hand?
Mr. Jordan?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, there is no regulation or regulatory requirement that it be kept on hand. When this was originally set up back in 1988, it was really to kind of take the spikes out of claims. In other words, we anticipate, quite a few claims, but if we had a large claim that was unanticipated, this was really to handle that. We're really leveraging this account to now handle the self-insured, potentially the self-insured aspect of property coverage, and allow us to retain the premiums that we're currently paying out for property insurance, and we'll continue to pay out if this was not in place.
Follow up. So I'm curious now. I'll give you a contrast. So one of the other appropriations we make on a recurring basis is for judgments and settlements against the state, which vary year to year, and we're never sure exactly how much that's going to be until it happens. Now, one could argue that we should anticipate that cost. We should set aside a pot of money for paying that purpose. We don't currently, that I'm aware of, and so it goes through the normal appropriation process. Can you contrast the plan in House Bill 102 to a competing plan, which would just say that we know there's going to be costs, we're going to treat them through the regular appropriations process year by year, as opposed to setting aside up to the $50 million?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Eastman, I believe that's typically how we look at this, and I say typically because the catastrophic fund really is there to cover unanticipated catastrophic losses. We historically and through our actuarial reports each year, we anticipate a certain amount of property claims, and if you look at the property losses on slide five, if you take out FY15 and part of FY20, we're looking at anywhere between $200,000 to $1.5 million a year in property losses. The CAT fund was there just to cover those large losses.
And follow up. And so I guess I'm looking for kind of a cost-benefit analysis. If I was to say that, House Bill 102, is Plan A, and Plan B is, I don't do anything, and I just wait to pay, those expenses when they come up year to year. What's the benefit to House Bill 102 compared to just sort of the wait-and-see approach?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the cost benefit I looked at it this way. We're currently buying coverage for the $50 million catastrophic losses. And we can, and as you can see from slide five, you know, we pay a varying amount, but that's going to increase. So let's say next year we pay $6.5 million for that coverage and we have no loss. It's just like any insurance, that $6.5 million is out the door. If we put that into the account and we have our own fund sitting there waiting for a catastrophic loss, we'll be saving the premiums year in and year out. And that savings is going to go back to the agencies in a rate reduction. So in other words, their rates are not going to be as high as let's say they are this year, for instance.
Yeah, follow up. So I'm all for not paying insurance companies money we don't need to be, but I don't think that quite gets to my question. Maybe I'm understanding this process incorrectly. But since there's no regulatory requirement that we keep money on hand, say the $50 million, and we're not, under this plan, planning on paying any premiums out to, you know, any of these insurance agencies and so forth, why is it more effective and more cost efficient for the state to have this fund than to not have this fund, or to, you know, set aside the scheme in House Bill 102 versus just stopping paying premiums, you know, and just charging you know, property damages to the state through the normal appropriations process, for example? And I'm sure there's an easy answer. I'm just trying to get this on the record. Thank you.
And Representative Easton, just to make sure I understand the question and maybe to play this forward to Mr. Jordan, the question you're asking is, why do we have the CAT fund, and if the McGrath snowshed collapses next year, like, what's wrong with us just, like, adding that as a line item in the capital budget and just paying it out in cash? Or if Tsunami wipes out Mount Edgecombe High School, adding $50 million to rebuild Mount Edgecombe High School? Is that
yes,
kind of
that is the question, and I'm trying to contrast that with judgments and settlements, and we have a logic for that process. I'm trying to contrast that logic with this process. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jordan.
Through the chair, back to Representative Eastman, one of the requirements that we do have catastrophic insurance is through FEMA. So if we want to benefit from, you know, FEMA coverages on, for instance, the earthquake coverage is a great example. There's been several buildings that have requested FEMA provide some sort of benefit to them. And in doing that, we have to show that we've insured buildings, and with this fund, this gives us the ability to do that without actually buying insurance. So I've talked to FEMA, and if we don't have this CAT fund and we don't buy insurance, they could deny coverage on a catastrophic loss such as an earthquake or a flood or a tsunami, that kind of thing.
Thank you. That's an excellent answer. In fact, that relates to my own experience. We have one of those buildings in my district, and we're all aware of the challenges with the insurance on that. So thank you very much. I appreciate that answer.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, just kind of follow-up commentary on the earlier line of questioning. So if you look at the difference between parking $5 million and parking $50 million, there's time value of money, there's opportunity costs, so what else could that $50 million be doing? And so the financial analysis of this would take all of that and roll it up. It would show, you know, like what the average or mean is of the charges that the insurance companies were paying. It would show how much headroom you have, and that would be the float in the system. And then we'd look at, is all of that optimized in terms of how it's being managed, and is the 50 the right size? So that number was arrived at through some analysis. I suspect it's back behind the scenes somewhere. And these other pieces that we're asking would really flesh out the whole picture. And this seems like a good idea, but those numbers and the evaluation of those numbers is what would prove that this is a good idea and there's not an opportunity being missed. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman. I'm just going to go in the circle that we originally started, Representative Klayman.
I want to make sure I understand the difference between the $5 million limit currently and the $50 million limit. Right now, the $5 million limit is what we use for the retention for purposes of purchasing insurance, which means that we pay the first $5 million and then the insurance kicks in when we hit that $5 million level on a particular claim. Have I got that right?
Through the chair, our retention is $1 million. The $5 million in the CAT fund, again, the CAT fund was initially set up to handle large losses that were unanticipated and could handle losses over that $1 million retention.
Okay, so follow up. So when we go to a $50 million in the fund, are you saying that the state is not going to be going out and purchasing excess coverage or some catastrophic coverage that would come into play when we have a loss exceeding a number much, much higher than a million? And is that number 50 million, or is there some point where even with this 50 million fund, we still are going to be purchasing excess coverage?
Through the chair, the current intention is to not purchase any excess coverage and allow this fund to cover property losses that are higher than anticipated. And I don't anticipate anything but a catastrophic loss to exceed something that we couldn't pay out of our yearly appropriations.
Follow up?
And this is specific to property losses, but am I accurate that in other areas which are non-property losses that the state has high retentions but still gets excess coverage in other areas of potential exposure?
Through the chair, to Representative Klayman, we are completely self-insured in workers' comp and in liability, so this would be added to those self-insurance programs. We do purchase excess insurance for aviation and marine, and we do have some smaller policies for bond and foreign liability, that kind of thing. But aviation, marine are a couple of other lines of business that we have with high retentions and high excess limits.
Follow up.
And your historical analysis is that we haven't, for a number of years, we haven't needed any excess coverage in the areas where we have chosen to be 100% self-insured?
Through the chair, to Representative Klayman, I would say that is a accurate statement for property. For liability, I think it was, again, a cost issue back in the early 2000s when we elected to self-insure liability. The premiums were doing the same thing that property is. They were getting up high enough that it just didn't make sense to make sense to purchase the coverage. We had a $5 million limit on liability, and the premiums were getting up closer to $2 million back in the early 2000s. So it was basically a cost analysis.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So now the current status of the catastrophe reserve account, is that money subject to reappropriation by the legislature?
Mr. Chair, I think I would defer that over to Director Isaacs again.
And Director Isaacs, feel free to speak to that. And I also want to note that Paloma Harbor from OMB is also on the line and available. So Mr. Isaacs, Ms. Harbor, either of you, please feel free to speak to Representative Eastman's question.
Thank you, Chairman Kreis-Tompkins. If Paloma had a good answer, otherwise I was going to get back to the committee on that.
Ms. Harbor?
Can you repeat the question?
Yes. So my first question is the catastrophe reserve account that we're speaking about in this bill, under current law, and I don't think that's going to change in the bill, are those funds subject to reappropriation by the legislature?
No, it is not. It's a fund that's not subject to future, it does not require appropriation to spend.
Follow up. And once the funds are deposited into this account, can the legislature, pull them out and reappropriate them to someplace else?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, yes. The legislature always has the authority to take money out of designated general funds. Otherwise, they'd be considered dedicated funds, and we don't have dedicated funds. We're not allowed to have dedicated funds.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
And last question for now. And then the money that's going into this account, so up to the $50 million, is that subject to the sweep?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, yes, it is subject to the sweep.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. I was going to ask that very question. Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, I am wondering if this is a common practice that other states do with their catastrophic insurance, and are they having success if you have looked at other states doing this?
Through the chair, to Representative Story, there are other states that have had various different levels of self-insurance, whether it be just for fire loss or what we call fire losses. And there is a move. I did talk to our broker, and there is a move for quite a few public entities to self-insure the catastrophic loss portion, just because the premiums are going up for those losses. Yes,
Representative, I have a correction. This is Paloma.
Ms. Harbor, please go ahead.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. This fund, because it does not require further appropriation, it is exempt from the sweep.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Story, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you. A follow-up. So states are moving towards this, but they are just moving towards it. You don't have any experience of it, how it's played out in other states?
Through the chair, I do not, but I can certainly check with some of the other states. I'm part of a STREMA group, which is a state risk managers group, and I can put that question out there to see if any of them have had success or failures with this kind of self-insurance program.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I have a number of questions. Mr. Jordan, do you happen to know when the state switched over to self-insurance for both workers' comp and liability?
Mr. Chairman, I can give you roughly on workers' comp, it was in the mid-90s. I wasn't working for the division at that time, but it was, I believe, around 94 or 95. And then for general liability, it was switched in 2003.
Thank you. And you mentioned that the state purchases coverage for marine, and I think you said aviation, and have you explored the possibility of trying to potentially provide that kind of risk management coverage through this fund if the fund is ultimately able to grow to the size of $50 million for marine and aviation?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's a great question. We did actually look at that this year along with the property issue. And mostly we looked at the marine hull side, in other words, not liability, but the vessels themselves, damages to the vessels themselves, and same thing with aviation, the hulls being self-insured. And I think with with aviation especially, we could do that, put it as part of a self-insured program for just the hulls. I don't know that I'd want to do it for aviation liability because the state owns quite a few airports, and our liability exposure and what we purchase for insurance is $500 million. On the marine side, same situation because of the last clearing highways and the passengers. We have a $1 billion liability coverage, and I just don't think that this fund would cover that if we had any kind of catastrophic loss.
Thank you. Yeah, interesting with the ferry system because the resale value of some of those vessels seems to be negative, but I get that the replacement value is different. What is the premium the state pays for that marine insurance policy?
Through the chair, let me see if I can get that. I believe it was about $3.8 million this year, but I do have a spreadsheet here that should tell me. I apologize, I didn't have it at my fingertips here. Yeah, I don't have that up. I can get all the premiums back to you, but I believe the marine side for vessels and for liability was about $3.8 million this year.
Thank you. And if possible, in your follow-up to my office, include the premium size for aviation policy, too. I think I at least would be interested in that. And I see a couple more questions, and I'm just going to follow one more line of questioning before I pass it off to Representative Vance and Representative Kaufman. Ms. Harbor, you mentioned your correction that the fund was not sweepable. I'm a little foggy on the different interpretations of what, you know, is and is not sweepable, and I think one of the problems is there is no definitive interpretation, and in fact we just consider legislation to provide that interpretation in the Judiciary Committee. And I think it was 2 years ago when we kind of went to the 11th hour and 59th minute of potentially sweeping funds because of, I have very strong feelings about this, but legislative inaction to reverse the sweep. Was there an interpretation from the Attorney General that this fund was in fact not sweepable?
Again, I'm sorry, I didn't state for the record. This is Paloma Harbor with the Office of Management and Budget. So one of the criteria from the court case related to sweepable funds was that funds that are not subject to further appropriation are not sweepable. And so that is one clear criteria.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you. I would just like the department to provide a list of all of the insurance policies that the state has and a comparative list of the policies that are self-insured, just so that we can have a larger view of what we're looking at. And if the dates could be provided on when those accounts became self-insured, I think that would be helpful for us.
Mr. Jordan, would it be possible to provide that to my office as Representative Vance requested?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we can definitely provide that information.
I think it'd be helpful. I think we've covered a lot of it verbally, but maybe just to have it in one place visually would be helpful. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, with respect to the earlier questions about how the fund would be managed, additional helpful piece of information would be the management fees expressed as a expense ratio. Thank you.
And Mr. Jordan, is that also something that could be provided?
Mr. Chair, I would love to tell you yes, but I'm not quite sure on the fund management side, so I would probably have to defer that to either Paloma Harbor or Leslie Isaacs to answer.
Ms. Harbor, being an OMB, do you have any insight as the answer to Representative Kaufman's question?
Again, Paloma Harbor for the record. Yes. So we can certainly work with Department of Revenue to get you more information to answer some of the questions. Currently, the fund is managed in the same bucket as the regular general fund bucket of money because it is so fluid. But we'll talk to Department of Revenue on if there's alternatives for investing it differently once we implement this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Harber. I know that would be appreciated. Further questions from the committee on House Bill 102? Representative Goffman is good. Great. Well, I just want to speak for myself to the agency and to OMB that I just think this is terrific legislation and just the kind of thing that, I mean, want to commend the administration for bringing a proposal like this forward and identifying where savings can occur, and it just makes no sense to shovel millions of dollars out the door to insurance companies when we need every dollar we can get. So this is just terrific, and it's at least my intent that as soon as the administration can provide some of the information provided, that we can try to get this back before us ASAP and set an amendment deadline. So if that provides any incentive, just know that's the intent of the chair. And seeing no further questions on House Bill 102, we'll set it aside for the time and want to do a preview of next week. So on Tuesday, we're going to take up House Bill 5, sponsor substitute for House Bill 5, and take public testimony on that legislation and also committee questions from the sponsor's office and other experts. And then on House Bill 55, do the exact same thing, public testimony and further committee questions, and hopefully be able to set amendment deadlines for both of those pieces of legislation thereafter. There's no state affairs hearing this Saturday, but per what I mentioned on the record on Tuesday, we'll be diving into a Saturday meeting the weekend after, this coming weekend, with three pieces of legislation. And Representative Eastman, did I see your hand go up for a comment or a question? Oh, I'm sorry. So with that, that concludes our business for today. Many thanks to Sophia and Tom and our fearless committee, Jeff Stepp, for facilitating today's meeting. And at 4:06 p.m., we are adjourned.